Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined to discuss COP26, the climate crisis emergency, what can and should be done, and in particular, from the perspective of social justice, that is the idea of a transition that would meet the climate needs and also the needs of society to ensure that we enhance equality rather than making inequality even worse. This is possible. And I'm delighted to be joined by Sinead Mercier, who is a lecturer in environmental law and policy and an ERC researcher in the UCD Sutherland School of Law. And also by Dr. Jamie Gorman, who is a lecturer in community and youth work and the convener of the Climate Justice Working Group of Community Workers Ireland, and who also, very interestingly, we mightn't get time to talk about it today, but maybe another time, spent 18 months recently in a Buddhist forest monastery in Sussex. And as I was saying to him, that's an incredible amount of time to be able to reflect on clarity. So I'm expecting amazing clarity from Jamie now. And as I said, I probably haven't had 2 seconds of silence in a long, long time. But and we're also hopefully going to be joined by Aideen Doherty, Associate Professor of DCU, who is in COP in Glasgow. So hopefully we will be joined by her in a while. But and just a reminder to our listeners and a plea as well, that Reboot Republic is produced by Tortoise Shack Media, Tony Groves, and it is completely reliant on patrons to cover the cost of production. It costs significantly to produce these podcasts. They don't appear by magic fairies, unfortunately, but they do cost and take quite a bit of time to produce and put out on all the hosting platforms. So if you can, please become a patron, which is a supporter. Sign up for whatever you can each month, and you can go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack to become a supporter. And if you have any issues you would like us to see raise in Reboot Republic, or guests you'd like us to have on, or comment on the episodes, or give out yards about me, you can email rebootrepublic@gmail.com or contact me on Twitter at Rory Hearn or on Instagram. Now, Sinead Mercier first, in terms of COP, is it all blah, blah, blah?
So I suppose the interesting thing about this COP is that it is the first kind of major diplomatic event after the start of the pandemic. So you have about 120 world leaders, you know, heads of states arriving. You know, you have Biden for the first time re-entering the agreement after Trump pulled out. You have representation from almost every country apart from President Xi, and also in Russia as well. However, the Chinese president hasn't left the country in since the start of the pandemic. So that mightn't be entirely because of lack of commitment to climate action. So it is you have a huge amount of world leaders who want this to be a good news story, that they are taking climate change as seriously as they have taken the pandemic, that and Andreas Mann has written a brilliant book on this, on the you know, the how the action on the pandemic and coronavirus was so fast and so kind of, you know, strong armed of the in terms of the state and protection of communities and citizens, as compared to climate change, which has just taken, I mean, at least 30 years now to take seriously. So in one way, that's a positive. And also the wall-to-wall coverage by media has just been insane. I mean, that's just fantastic. As someone working in this area for around like 8 years or almost a decade now, that's definitely a shift. However, in terms of the COP itself, I am not, I think that it's been 30 years of kind of on this road. I'm 32 now, and they've been debating about taking climate action seriously for as long as I've been alive, if not longer, and it's not working. I mean, emissions are even higher than ever. Despite a blip with the pandemic, we're seeing the ESRI and others and the IEA saying there's going to be a massive jump in emissions anyway, despite the lessons learned from the pandemic, that you can look after populations without high carbon. You can have basic income, universal basic services, and so on, and provide all that, you know, green economists have been telling us you can do it. But I suppose, so there's a great article by Haley Stevenson called Climate Change in the Age of Bullshit. Or like, and I just think that it's sort of like the how she defines bullshit is by reading this article, by Henry Frankfurt, in that a bullshitter acts and speaks without any regard for how things really are. And it's closer to bluffing than it is to lying. And it's sort of when, and we can see it particularly in politics at the moment, when like Trump was a classic example of being willingly unintelligible in a way to impress his spurious support to a claim, to kind of not care entirely about the truth. Not that you're lying, but you don't entirely care about the truth. It's more to be seen to be saying something. And I feel her work is very interesting and on this. And I feel that's what the COP kind of is a kind of an example of 30 years of climate action policies, market mechanisms to deal with climate change, despite them just not working. I mean, we're looking now at a replacement of the Clean Development Mechanism under the Kyoto Protocol, which completely failed. That was like a basically, allowing countries, rich countries, to buy the right to pollute through emissions trading licenses. Very complicated, probably willingly so, deliberately so. And now that's been replaced under Article 6 with a new similar kind of global emissions trading scheme. And as we know from the EU ETS, that hasn't worked for a long time. I think it reduced emissions by maybe 3-5%. And this kind of obsession with cost-effective climate action, that you don't interfere with economic growth, but you take the climate action that it allows the economy to operate as it is, just decoupled from emissions, which has been completely or offset by buying, forests or buying projects in other countries, developing countries. And I think that whole, that's kind of what we're hopefully going to see at this COP, that maybe that will break. Maybe this COP, as an aging can speak to this, she's just arrived, I see, that the civil society, NGOs, Global South, small island developing nations are being blocked out of the negotiations, being blocked out of the kind of main negotiation rooms so that they can't derail it, so that they can't protest, young climate strikers as well. We're kind of hitting a crux point in that the bullshit basically is not being taken anymore or is being highlighted. And world leaders don't want that to happen, that embarrassment, I suppose, with this first diplomatic event after the pandemic. They want a good news story, but maybe this is the time that we'll see it for what it is for once. So that's a long introduction, but...
No. I think it frames it very, very well, Sinead, and introduces it very well. And as Sinead said, we're joined by Aideen Doherty, Associate Professor in the Centre for Climate Sustainability in DCU, and also representing Not Here, Not Anywhere at COP. Maybe we go to you, Aideen. Obviously, I assume you swam over there anyway as your mode of transport. In terms of, what is going on and what Sinead talks about there, the bullshit that, people are being sold, and we're hearing it from our own government as well, talking about these amazing commitments to climate change, and weirdly then been framed in the Irish media that somehow, Micheál Martin went over there as a green radical and was joining Greta in terms of his commitments. But actually, I felt a lack of questioning. But from your experience, what is happening over there? Is it significant? Or is it global leaders just trying to assuage the growing public demand for real action on climate change? And are we heading, as Sinead talks about, to a real, pinch conflict point between the movements who are looking and public looking for real action and the failure of leaders to act? Or do you think we're going to see something significant?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. If you can't hear me or anything, just let me know, because I'm in kind of like this is called the action zone, so where the media and stuff are, and I came here for good Wi-Fi, hopefully. But hopefully you can't hear background noise or anything. Yeah, this is my first COP, and it's such an interesting experience. I've been here since Monday. So I've been here since Monday, staying for a week, and I'm currently in like what's called the blue zone, which is kind of the official area where the negotiations take place. So all our, the Irish delegation is here, which is all our civil servants from the Department of Environment, Foreign Affairs, you know, a couple of people from agriculture as well, various other departments. So this is like the official area. The negotiations all happen in these kind of meeting rooms. They're all sort of hidden away. We don't have access to, so I'm on what's called a party overflow badge, which is basically the government gave out various, they gave out maybe like 30 or 40 badges to kind of NGOs, some activists. So I'm here as a Not Here Not Anywhere member. We're an anti-fossil fuel activist group. We campaign on LNG terminals. So yeah, plug, follow us, look us up. So I got a badge as part of Not Here Not Anywhere. But those badges, like Sinead was saying, like things are quite segregated. There's apparently less access this year. I've been hearing from people who've been here before that like we're not allowed into the negotiations. You know, you used to be able to go in and observe them. We're not allowed in, and we're not allowed into like even the plenary rooms, which is where, say, Micheál Martin's speech was yesterday. And we managed to sneak in, but like technically we're not allowed in there. So there's kind of, they're very much trying to keep civil society. I mean, I guess you could say that's a COVID. A COVID thing, maybe restricting numbers. That's certainly what they're saying, but it's probably because there were, at the last COP, there were protests in these plenary rooms. So that's like the official side of COP, which is this blue zone area, and then this is where all the media and stuff are as well. And then you have like, it's like there are two COPs. It's totally different. Like the outside protest kind of COP that's happening. So that's sort of on the streets of Glasgow. Like I was at there was greenwashing protests this morning outside a big shopping center, and I think it was Extinction Rebellion. And then there's a big, there's a school strike on Friday, and then the big kind of general march is on Saturday, and the Global Day of Action is Saturday. So that's a big rally in Glasgow. Greta Thunberg is speaking. Hopefully we'll get to see her, and loads of other great activists. And there's a march in Dublin and various other cities around Ireland as well on Saturday. But yeah, so that's like and it's very, very separated. Like the activists aren't getting anywhere near the venue. Like this blue zone area is totally fenced off. Like it's like, yeah, it's like Fort Knox. Like it's crazy. There's all these big security barriers, loads and loads of police. Like, and particularly yesterday, because the World Leader Summit, whatever, but they have this police everywhere. So the protests are kind of very, I mean, Glasgow's not a,
I think we might have lost
the protest very separate. So it means that there's leaders aren't hearing those voices.
Yeah. And Aideen, just in terms of the substantive, again, you know, changes that you think might come out of this, again, that question, what do you think could happen in relation to that? Are we likely to see changes in more deeper commitments from governments?
Yeah. So like a few big things that people are talking about this week, like today is finance day. So there's a theme for every day of the COP, and today, so everyone's talking about climate from the richer countries basically. And Micheál Martin said yesterday, like the sort of the new thing in his speech yesterday, like his speech. So they each got the various prime ministers and world leaders. I hate the phrase world leaders. It's very, anyway, they each had 3 minutes yesterday, and in his 3 minutes there was that much new in it. You know, he said like this is urgent and we are going to, you know, Ireland takes it seriously and all that, we'll play our part, the rich nations. The new thing was this doubling of the climate finance commitment. So up to what I've heard, like some of the observers, some of the NGOs think we don't know yet. It's actually, you know, hopefully that's the way it's going to be. And it's still far short of, you know, what Ireland should be contributing in climate finance. So, yes, yeah, so that in theory, it's a
Unfortunately, Aideen's connection is just gone. So I'm going to go to Jamie Gorman from the Department of Applied Social Studies in Maynooth, colleague of mine. Jamie, what's your sense of COP and, you know, what could be achieved?
Sure, Rory. Well, I mean, as Sinead as it's pointed out, you do need a very finely tuned bullshit detector to be able to sift through the speeches and the promises and be able to tell what is bluff from what is real and what's going to actually address the issues. And really, when it comes to this COP, the core issue is how do we is the final setting out of the Paris, what they call the Paris Rulebook. So the Paris Agreement, finalised in 2015, has not yet been fully implemented because we haven't yet agreed the rules of the game. And so what happens at this COP will be crucial for setting us on course for, you know, a decade of delivery in terms of climate action, or a decade of more bullshit, more blah, 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 and false promises that don't add up to real climate action. And the two things that we need to make progress on at this COP are emissions reductions and fossil fuel phase out on the one hand, and then climate finance, countries putting up money to support adaptation to climate change that is happening, and crucially as well for the small island states and for the least developed countries, finance for the loss and damage that they're already facing and they can't adapt to due to climate change. And as Aideen said, although I think we lost you a little bit, one of the big headline announcements from Micheál Martin yesterday was the $225 billion a year of climate finance that Ireland is pledging by 2025 now, not by tomorrow or the next day. But again, as Aideen said, although that is over doubling of what we have, what we've been given since last year, it still falls €129 million short of what Ireland's fair share would be in terms of global climate finance. The other thing to point out about the climate finance negotiations is that since 2009, we've been, at a global level, we've been struggling to get to €100 billion per annum of climate finance pledged. That's a political figure, which actually doesn't reflect the needs and the reality of countries, particularly in the global south, for climate finance, you know, which is far greater. So although we've seen some progress on climate finance, it's nowhere near our fair shares. And then the other thing in terms of the sort of tuning into the bullshit that is really important for people to be aware of is that the UK government is really looking to position themselves as climate leaders in these negotiations, and particularly post-Brexit, you know, as a sort of a global diplomatic powerhouse. Paris was a great success for the French. And they want to be able to replicate that and say that they've equally, they're equally able to stand on the world stage. And their agenda is around four C's for this COP. They call it cars, cash, coal, and canopy. And they want to see progress on all of these. So reduction of emissions by addressing emissions from transport and emissions from coal. They want countries to pledge to stop extracting coal. And they also want to see the climate finance pledges beefed up, and then the canopy C of their agenda is around addressing deforestation. So again, all of this stuff sounds wonderful, and you know, it's absolutely necessary, but the devil is in the detail. And really, the core thing to look out for is, and this is what civil society, global civil society, is really challenging them on, is that net zero doesn't actually mean real zero in terms of emissions reduction. So net zero is the balance between the amount of greenhouse gases that are produced and the amount that are removed from the atmosphere, which means that states are looking to continue to extract fossil fuels and continue to burn fossil fuels, but are going to use financial mechanisms, market mechanisms such as carbon trading, or ill-proven are still to be proven technologies like carbon capture and storage and other sort of geoengineering approaches to attempt to balance the books. So the idea is we can keep polluting as long as we regulate the market And we have technological solutions that will, we hope, at some point in the future, reduce the emissions again. So really, it's it gets in the way of reducing emissions at source, which is what we need to do, which is to stop burning fossil fuels. We need to make urgently make the transition to renewables and put in place resources to do that. So, you know, say, for example, in Ireland, we're still, as of 2019, we were still subsidizing fossil fuels to the tune of 2.4 billion. And 87% of our electricity is burned. It was generated through fossil fuels. And we just need to stop doing that and redirect that finance towards the energy transition.
Yeah, there's a lot there, Jamie. And I think it's a really important concept, that idea of real zero rather than net zero. And I might go to Aideen again, if she's back with us, just to outline, just you were giving a response, Aideen, in terms of analysis of what the Irish government spoke about yesterday. And maybe you could give us that again.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I was talking about the climate finance that Jamie mentioned.
No, I'm afraid, Aideen, we'll have to leave that. We'll have to try to get you again another time. Well, listen, we'll come back to you again. In terms of Sinead, maybe just coming in on in terms of what Jamie was saying there around, you know, the idea of real zero rather than net zero. How do you think, you know, what should actually be done in real terms to address the climate emergency, do you think?
Yes, that's a big question.
You're well.
It's a big question. And Aideen's done a lot of work on this as well, but not here, not anywhere, you know, who've been really fantastic in the Irish context, because I suppose for myself, just having worked, I lecture in environmental law and policy, and last year in Maynooth, and I come in from a legal background. So as a kind of, to take us in terms of the broader perspective, basically environmental law and policy is fascinating in that it, first of all, doesn't have a subject. So the environment isn't like justice, so like just criminal justice law or law in terms of it's or tort, for example, where, you know, you have civil liability for a harm that's been caused. So it addresses the environment in terms of the environment is sort of like resources or products or things that should be exploited. That the environment is there for, you know, economic gain or for, you know, human gain, but primarily economic gain. And that's how it's treated. Like land, particularly Irish, if you look at law in terms of land internationally as well, it comes from, you know, kind of colonization as well, in that land law was developed in order to move the existing people who were living there off the land and kind of created into an economic product. So environmental law is really interesting in that it treats the environment in terms of market mechanisms or voluntary agreements. It doesn't, if you compare it to, say, so as an example of an international environmental law prior to the current COP, which is under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, there was the Montreal Protocol to deal with the hole in the ozone layer. Yeah. And what that did was it banned CFCs. So it banned a particular type of chemical which causes the hole in the ozone layer. Okay, just banned them. And they used to be in aerosols. They used to be in refrigerants, fridges in particular, freezers. And they were banned in Europe. And what happened in the US was that in California and particular part of the US, they developed a way to phase out the CFCs through a market mechanism. So countries could, businesses could reduce the amount of CFCs they had and kind of sell the permit to release that they had earned because they had reduced themselves to someone that had reduced too much. And this market mechanism approach was then used by the US as the terms of the US entering into the Kyoto Protocol. So the Kyoto Protocol in the 1990s and agreed to fully in the 2000s was developed to as a means of countries around the world reducing their emissions in terms of carbon and in terms of climate change. But because of years of environmental law being watered down, particularly under Reagan and under Thatcher in the EU, you move from command and control regulation, which just banned bad chemicals, asbestos, for example, banned in the EU, quite stringently in most aspects in the EU. But in the US, it's still produced because they used a kind of more, it wasn't kind of this command and control approach. It was, and what you have was the US kind of pressuring the EU, who wanted basically a ban on fossil fuels, you know, that they would be phased out entirely out of production. So it was focusing on supply side contributors to climate change, not demand side. So as an example, demand side approaches to climate change are encouraging people to buy electric cars rather than banning SUVs. So that's an example. A supply side approach would ban the production of LNG in Ireland, ban oil and gas extraction in Ireland, make it illegal to, have coal-based power stations across the world, oil and gas as well, and mandate that countries find some way to produce everything 100% of their electricity systems and energy systems through renewables. But instead, we have an approach which encourages businesses to produce renewables through subsidies and refit schemes and contracts for difference in the UK. And what that has created is the scenario where initially fossil fuels are operating in parallel, are growing in parallel with renewable energy. So Scotland is a great example. They are world leaders in offshore wind. They have huge amounts of offshore wind being produced. Yet until maybe a few days ago, they had a policy of maximizing the recovery of every drop of oil and gas off the coast in the North Sea. So the two of them are operating alongside one another, rather than one being banned and then one being kind of like getting all the resources and the funding and the support as a result of that ban. And that is like a deliberate political choice that developed under kind of neoliberal environmental policies, particularly under Reagan in the US, that was then brought into the Kyoto Protocol in the 1990s under the Clinton administration. They lobbied and pushed and bullied basically the EU and the Global South to accept market mechanisms such as the Clean Development Mechanism and the Joint Implementation Mechanism. They bullied them into taking this approach rather than the command and control approach, which was used for the ozone layer. And now it was called at the time was carbon colonialism by the Global South. They said that they're basically the right to use the remaining carbon space that we have in the atmosphere before we have runaway climate change. That was basically parceled up and commodified into permits for, you know, the people who've caused climate change, the 100 companies, fossil fuel companies. They now have the right to buy the right to pollute rather than it being treated as a human rights kind of issue or like a public health and safety issue or even an issue of civil liability, which is what the loss and damage mechanism is trying to do. Loss and damage is basically allowing developing countries to sue wealthier countries or companies even for causing climate induced disasters in their homes. So we now have the science that show that can link a particular climate disaster, so a typhoon or a cyclone, that actual incident can now be linked by scientists to the particular emissions coming from a particular country. It's a new development in climate science. And what loss and damage does is tries to introduce that idea of tort or civil liability into climate negotiations, that these countries can get compensation for being destroyed or their homes destroyed by the actions of wealthier countries. But I just find it so fascinating that 30 years of trying like voluntary network approaches to environmental law, market-based approaches to environmental law, we've been ignoring, you know, basically justice approaches or criminal justice approaches or human rights based approaches or tort based approaches, you know, practices that are, you know, much longer in the history of our legal frameworks and constitutional frameworks. And if I could advocate for one thing at all, it would be that take a criminal justice approach to climate action. You know, basically, who's causing it? Let's take a supply side approach, a production supply approach. Why is the UK pretending to be a climate leader by benefiting, while it also benefits and, you know, produces the licensing system for maximum economic recovery of oil and gas? That should just be criminalized. I'm sorry. You know, I just, and also brought into it a tort and civil liability framework as well. Like, I just think that that is so fascinating. And in terms of, you know, in terms of this idea of bullshit as well, I think there's a duty on NGOs and on environmental and climate activists too, to kind of stop supporting any sort of climate action that's happening, such as the emissions trading schemes, such as, you know, the carbon bait tax approach, which is fine, but it's only going to reduce emissions by 5 to 15%. And even then, it's still attached to this cost effectiveness approach to climate action, not a kind of human justice or climate justice approach. And I think that what you're doing then is that you're strengthening the fakers or reassuring waivers that they don't need to get involved and that we don't need to tell the truth about what's happening. You know, it's what Hayley Stevenson calls it is a deficit of ecological integrity. You know, we're celebrating climate bills and celebrating a process in international law that is not in line with ecological integrity. It's not going to reduce emissions. It's going to increase them so that we hit 2.7 degrees warming. And I think there's a duty in us to look at the processes that we've adopted over the last 30 years and say they're bullshit, because they are. So...
I think that you have given an absolute decimation of the climate approaches, and rightfully so, utterly torn them apart. And that should be put up as a special little public service broadcast on RT the last 2 minutes, what you've just set out there, brilliantly put out. And I think it absolutely is. Yeah, it is right to call it bullshit, and it does need to be named. And I think in that sense that the crisis is so entrenched, and yet the responses are so entrenched within a neoliberal capitalist framework, and which is ultimately based on a completely, you know, continued, we know this, yet nobody, you know, names it, unsustainable consumption continually, you know, this endless growth. And Jamie, maybe to bring you back in there on that question of, there's two questions, maybe one that, you know, is it possible under capitalism with its approach to actually get a sustainable environment? You know, and is it a question, well, you look at countries like Sweden, a more social democratic approach that can manage capitalism in a way that actually could achieve the climate, the targets that are required to really address the climate emergency? That's the first question. And the second one, I know, is something that you've, you know, done a lot of work on, and is that question of climate justice and what is climate justice? And how can we address that through this?
Yeah, big questions as well, Rory.
They are indeed. And I'm not one who goes into often, I don't often talk about capitalism on this podcast, which people are very surprised about. Well, we're talking about it all the time, but not in that sort of, you know, because sometimes it's created as this kind of system thing that nobody can really, you know, touch or tackle. But I think with this, there is a fundamental question of our economic approach and our economic model.
I really do believe that capitalism is incompatible with climate justice. And that's because the mode of economic development that we label capitalism relies on treating the environment as a pool of raw materials which we can exploit, and as a dump for our for pollutants and our waste material. And so we need to recognise that the economy has to sit within the environment. The environment provides the external boundaries for the economy, and not the other way around. And so I really appreciate the work of the people like the Stockholm Environmental Institute, who developed the idea of planetary boundaries, which Kate Raworth went on to extend to the social floor and then the planetary ceiling in the donut model, which I think really provides a framework for thinking about how do we design our economy in a way that respects both the need for development, the need for human rights, the need for justice, and the need for protection of the environment and respecting of environmental boundaries.
And in terms of that, you know, question then of climate justice and inequality within this, the transition, because on the one hand we have, you know, we're saying, and Sinead is setting out and many other people are setting out that, you know, the what's proposed by governments at the moment is not enough. It's nowhere near enough in terms of addressing it. But yet a lot of the framing in the media and discussion is that, oh, well, how are we even going to convince people of this? And yes, it's something that, you know, I think in the area of housing, for example, I think is something that, you know, we know if we actually borrow to invest in refurbishing vacant property, in giving people, you know, retrofitting their homes, not through a market mechanism, but actually the state funding it, you could actually give people a real dividend from the transition. But that is not the approach.
Yeah, I think there's a real lack of imagination and a lack of political courage. And very often, you know, the Irish state and other states have not sold the benefits of the transition. You know, they haven't even began to think about what would a green transition look like for good quality jobs, for farmers, and for you know, the availability of good food and cheap energy, which, you know, are all all there to be seized. Those opportunities are there to be seized if we had imagination and leadership. You know, I really do believe that climate, you know, I'm passionate about climate justice because I'm a community worker, and I really do believe that climate action with a justice focus is something that will deliver social justice and equality and inclusion for communities. It will address marginalization and inequality in our society if we get it right. So it's like what Naomi Klein says, you know, this is not just the greatest challenge we face, but the biggest opportunity we have to create a better world if we can take leadership and have imagination now. And very often the government, I think, seems to stumble the lack of public will to take climate action. You know, the recent Irish Times poll, which noted that although, you know, Ireland has a very high level of public acceptance of climate change and support for climate action when it comes to specific measures such as the carbon tax, public support rapidly drops. And of course, if you frame climate action in terms of taxation, in terms of blackouts, which is what that Irish Times poll did, you know, who's going to support more blackouts, you know?
Yeah.
So it's about selling the positives and really investing in taking action to drive climate action in our communities that also has co-benefits for the economy, for food production, for energy production.
Yeah. And in terms of, there are specific examples you say we need to do it right, you know, when you talk about that, like, is there specific examples you could think of, or, you know, that you're aware of that we could be doing now, you know?
Well, to look at those three areas, for example, you know, community ownership of renewable energy is really blossoming across Europe, and there are a number of specific things that the state could do to really allow that to ramp up, you know, in terms of providing greater support. So they already do things through the SEAI, the Sustainable Energy Authority, but there is much more that could be done to support communities to have the benefits of renewable energy production in the local area. In terms of food production, you know, I look to the likes of the Cork Food Policy Council in Ireland and other initiatives across Europe, which are about bringing together different stakeholders in the food system, the producers, the consumers, and organisations that are concerned with equality and inclusion, to make sure that everybody has access to good quality food, and the farmers have been paid a fair wage. So, you know, there are models in those areas that we can look to draw on and scale up. And similarly then, in terms of the economy, you know, I am really impressed with and draw inspiration from the Preston model in the UK, which is about community wealth building. So really thinking about how can we use what they call in the model anchor institutions, like universities, like hospitals, who have big budgets and big spending, often of public money, and redirecting it through procurement to local businesses to kick, to catalyze the local economy, rather than that money being drawn upwards into the global economy. So, there are definitely models that are not very, they're not very complex. They're not very difficult to get your head around. Models and ideas that really could both have benefits in terms of climate action and benefits in terms of social justice and addressing poverty and inequality.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. There's some really interesting ideas there. Thanks, Jamie. Sinead, just in terms of the housing issue, the retrofit targets that we have set are woefully inadequate in terms of retrofitting housing, for example, and very much along the lines of what you said out there, that market model. And, we saw the Department of Finance poo-pooing the ESRI recommendations to borrow additional money, that saying that, we don't want to do this. Is our state, it's just, as you say, complete bullshit that, on the one hand, the state says, the government says, and the Minister for Housing would say, oh yeah, we're completely committed to, we are developing, we need to retrofit. And they're using the language of it, saying we're going to retrofit. But actually, when you look through the figures, they're nothing in comparison to, actually a retrofitting or even the building of new homes, the type of homes that we're building. That housing is actually an area that we could really address inequality and social justice and achieve a climate transition. But the way in which we do it really has to shift to ultimately the state funding housing and doing it through, as Jamie talks about, community models there as well. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think it's something you touch on in your book as well, on retrofitting and climate action.
With advice from you, Sinead, with advice from you, name it what it was.
But it's definitely a win-win, the retrofitting and the housing, you're addressing energy poverty, you're addressing the poor kind of building standards as well from the past. So Orla Hegarty has great work on that in the present. You also have a very interesting situation. There's a fantastic lecture in TUD. I will get the name, but I remember I was at a talk with her on energy poverty, and she's done a fantastic study which has shown that all the kind of easy wins in terms of heating, improving housing in terms of heat, are more or less almost done. So in terms of, so if you're on the fuel allowance, you can get insulation for your roof. You can get particular kind of small sort of insulation activities like that as well, if you're on the fuel allowance. And a lot of those actions have actually been done. So that is a positive in terms of, like, you do see actions are being done in terms of those kind of smaller improvements of housing. But now we're at the stage where we need to do the deep retrofits, where we need to do the massive kind of job of really warming homes, really improving them, really bringing them up to standard. And that's that's going to be a huge job, and it's going to be a very expensive job. But it's expensive in terms of how you look at it. So, if you're taking this kind of very narrow marginal abatement cost curve, cost effectiveness approach that only looks at kind of, cost in terms of, basically money, maybe with a carbon tax kind of added on to give some sort of semblance to the widespread harm that carbon does. But in terms of other benefits, like in terms of, that wider perspective of jobs, of well-being, if you look at education, if you can't really take a marginal abatement cost curve approach to education, neither can you with housing, neither can you with climate action. And I think, like, there's great work by Neary as well, which shows that you could basically deliver a kind of real revolution in jobs, good quality Green New Deal type approach to jobs and employment and the construction industry. You could basically mandate that there be decent work in the construction industry through these kind of local authority led or a particular new state agency led approach to retrofitting all the houses that need it. And I suppose the interesting thing here for me in terms of if you take a step back as to why that's not happening, is there's a brilliant book by Simon Perani called Burning Up. And he basically tracks in it the reason why, you know, the first renewable fuel, which is energy efficiency, is not being developed as much as maybe renewables are, or even kind of lower carbon, inverted commas, fuels like gas, which we now know isn't actually lower carbon because of the methane it releases. And it's just fascinating because he kind of tracks the fact that energy efficiency basically is just undermines your profits. You can't make a profit with energy efficiency. Yeah. You know, because the whole way that the energy system has been geared to, not always now, energy systems were, you know, from the Industrial Revolution period, obviously you had the Elon Musks of the time, even if you think of the name of his car, the Tesla, and the pioneers of energy at the time who were doing it because they were interested in electricity, or, you know, there were new discoveries, and you had kind of like, you know, particular business interested people who set up whole towns on based on electricity. But it was all kind of ad hoc and led by private interest or like individual interest. But from the sort of when energy became very important for nation building, for the idea of the nation state, energy systems were based on national security, which is why you had the repeated fights over the Ruhr, the coal and steel kind of development there. And in 100 years ago, when Ireland, in 1921, when it set out on its path of independence, one of the first things it did was nationalise the energy system under the ESB and create an energy system that was based on energy sovereignty, you know, so that it wouldn't be under the thumb or reliance on the UK, built Ordna Krusha, despite it costing a fifth of our national debt at the time, or national budget at the time. And energy systems used to be based on this idea of national security and modernization, modernizing the economy, bringing light and education to the public. Particularly in Ireland, the ESB had a public good mandate, not-for-profit mandate. The Bord na Móna had a rural development mandate as well, that it had to hire local people. The ESB was based around working with Siemens and gaining education and expertise from Germany and other countries. It was all about nation building and decolonizing in other ways as well, our reliance on energy from other countries, and the idea of setting out Sinn Féin, you know, ourselves alone. And unfortunately, energy systems from the 70s and 80s, but particularly 80s and 90s in Europe, started being seen as another privatization opportunity. And particularly, I suppose at the time, the education around it as well was not maybe, I mean, climate action, this was considered good for climate action as well, because you were breaking up the incumbents, the coal incumbents. You were breaking up the big energy companies that were at the time very reliant on coal and oil, you know. But at the same time as well, there was also a political element to it. I mean, you had a real push, as Timothy Mitchell in his book Carbon Democracy lays out, he argues anyway in his book, that a lot of the wins for working class communities and the vote for working class men, and then kind of wider sections of the population from that onwards, were led by basically communities who worked in mining or in power stations in this new context of energy sovereignty for the state, where these communities could literally, by stopping to work or going on strike, they could break the entire state. They could just lay down their tools, and then you had no more coal mining. So therefore you had no more industry or no more, you know, particularly in wartime as well. So you had this context of energy being very linked to working class kind of power. Now he argues, and Andreas Malm as well in his book, Fossil Capital. And then you have a massive kind of push in the 80s and 90s, starting with structural adjustment programs in Latin America, in South and Central America, the first energy system to be privatized and liberalized was under the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile, and which was kind of considered at the time, you know, quite bad for the country. And also, you know, was accompanied by a lot of kind of, as you know, at the time, under that dictatorship.
Horrific treatment, yeah, of people under the name of neoliberalism at that time. And
yes, and that's kind of, so basically our energy systems were have been attached to a neoliberal kind of ideology from the 90s onwards, like Thatcher closing down the conservative government at the time in the 80s had a real influence on the EU in general in terms of how it should direct its energy system. And there was a belief as well, a genuine belief, that it would lead to cheaper energy and would allow for, you know, renewable energy too. So those were genuine beliefs at the time. So far, they have not emerged in practice. And you have this idea that energy efficiency is just, energy efficiency is never going to work in a context of profit. A for-profit energy system will never reduce the root cause of its profits, which is maximizing the use of energy. And I think that's where we're kind of at the moment with climate change, with social injustice in terms of energy poverty, with low quality housing, is that the energy system, which is, I mean, let's remember the talk is often about farmers, but the primary cause of climate change is fossil fuels. It's the cause of climate change, carbon and the energy system that we have. And if it's focused on profit, rather than energy efficiency or public good, it's never going to tackle climate action or energy poverty. It's just not set up that way. And unfortunately, I mean, the evidence of that is that until now, the directives on climate action at EU level in term have always been mandatory in terms of electricity, in terms of privatization, liberalization, renewable share in the energy mix, climate action targets in terms of residential emissions, agriculture, transport, they have all been mandatory. The voluntary aspect is left for energy efficiency. The energy efficiency directives have always been voluntary, though they're mandatory and like you have to set targets for yourself, but you come up with them yourself. So like there's your evidence. Like it's not based on, like energy efficiency is just not the priority, despite being the best way to tackle climate change, you know? So,
which is really, really interesting. And again, your point made in the most detailed.
I'm sorry, very detailed.
An absolutely scholarly way. And it does raise absolutely that question. I think it's a really interesting perspective on why housing is not being retrofitted to the scale at which you would expect, because of course it means reduction in energy consumption and would mean that. So that's interesting. Just to finish, I might go to Jamie and then Sinead. Last question. The movements, the climate movements, the protests, where do you see that likely to go now as we see, again, we're likely to see another blah, blah, blah bullshit COP26 that doesn't really, which does a lot of spin, but won't materially change things. Are the protests likely to grow further, or is there a difficulty in this post-COVID context of, has the steam been taken out of the student strikes and the environmental movement to a certain extent, the protests, or how do you see it progressing?
It's a good question, Rowan. It's hard, I think, to be able to predict, because you know the peak of the student strikes was September 2019 and early 2020, and then COVID hit. And so those young people, that movement is still there. It's sort of re-emerging and re-finding its feet. And this is the first, coming up this Saturday, is the first sort of big global strike that's been possible since the pandemic. So I think it'll be interesting to see from Saturday kind of, that'll set the tone for the scale of the movement. But, you know, as Sinead said at the very start, climate politics, climate issues are more and more front and centre in the media. And the reality of the climate crisis is going to be more and more in our face as the months and the years go on. So I don't think the movements are going to go anywhere. And the question for those of us who are concerned with justice is that, you know, the fact that every single fraction of a degree of warming has a huge impact, a particularly on the most vulnerable and most marginalized communities and groups in Ireland and globally. And so it's all still to fight for. And you know, no matter what the outcome of this COP is in terms of ambition, I certainly will be continuing to march and raise my voice. And I think that the movements will be on the streets as well.
Great. Thanks, Jamie. Sinead?
Yes. Yeah, I think Jamie's totally correct. I think that we will definitely see more on the streets. We're also seeing kind of, like a COP, you know, it's more of a corporate event this year. That's Aideen was telling me as well, that even the Australian country, they have like a stand in the kind of country's platform area. So each country gets to highlight what they're doing on climate action. And the Australian stand has advertising and sponsorship from Santos, an oil and gas company. And that's really been highlighted, and those protests about how COP has become, you know, all about corporate sponsorship presentation of these companies who have caused climate change, pretending to take action and talking about ESG, talking about CSR and corporate social responsibility, despite ensuring at every point in the Paris Agreement that fossil fuels weren't mentioned. Also supply side policies, such as countries like Norway or the UK, you know, phasing out oil and gas production as opposed to consumption. And so everything's about consumption, but not production of oil and gas, because that would hit these companies. That's really been highlighted and coming to the fore. And my only hope and wish is that we will do that more in Ireland, because I think Ireland is a fantastic kind of linchpin for this, because we don't have a strong oil and gas industry. You know, our oil and gas industry has again and again been a source of great international shame, from Carb to, you know, ExxonMobil, you know, the links at the time that were made in Ireland from the community in Erris in County Mayo, which, you know, Jamie can talk a lot about as well. You know, with international solidarity in terms of the Ogoni people in Nigeria, how the LNG groups in Ireland are linking in with people in Pennsylvania or Azerbaijan and elsewhere. I just think that Ireland is, because we don't have such a strong oil and gas industry, and because it's had such a damning legacy in Ireland, we really are in such a wonderful place to kind of maybe, you know, be a leader in the world in kind of taking that supply side approach to climate action, which also, interestingly, though controversially, is something for agriculture in Ireland. You know, and like we take a supply side approach to agriculture, but not to oil and gas internationally, in terms of the way that carbon is counted. And I just think that there's a really good opportunity here to push for that supply side approach, maybe internationally, and, you know, pick up that kind of banning fossil fuel infrastructure kind of approach, and allowing for the space to happen here, because we don't have so many vested interests, you know. That would be something I would find really interesting going forward, and more international solidarity as well. Can we decolonize climate law? You know, can we stop this market-based approach and, you know, kind of CSR, ESG-based approach to climate action from Ireland, because of our great long-standing history in foreign aid, you know, and really strong kind of solidarity with the developing world and post-colonial countries. I think that there's hopefully a really good opportunity here, and I'd like us to take it up rather than maybe celebrating any climate action just because it's got climate written on the cover, you know, because I think the real issue is maybe greenwashing.
And I absolutely agree with you. I think that, you know, in this country, we absolutely have such a potential. We're a small country too. Do you know what I mean? We can make changes. And I think, you know, it needs to be part of that, you know, shift to a completely different way, a cooperative economy, a cooperative society that, you know, we value nature, what gives us. We're also very connected to nature in Ireland in a way that, you know, other countries aren't in the same way. You know, there's not many people in Dublin, even, you know, our largest city, who can't see the mountains, who can't, you know, from some part, or, are connected in some way to the sea, or, you know, the beaches around us, that, that, you know, nature is very close to us in Ireland. And I think that it is, it is something that gives us a way, and our system, I think. And also I think the generations who, again, I talk about this in relation to housing, but who brought repeal, who brought, you know, marriage equality, of a different value system about how our economy and society should run and what values should it be run on. And I think there's a real hope in that, that we could become a country that requires, it requires a major transformational shift from how we do things at the moment. But I do believe that there's enough energy out there, and there's a community history that could see us become a global leader in community, you know, orientated economy and protection for the environment. It's a, it's a bit of a road to go, but I think it's possible. And if you are interested, sorry, Sinead, yeah.
But even if you think of like our grandparents' generation, they were the low carbon leaders. You know, it was reuse, recycle, like Irish Country Women's Association. They were, I mean, if you could change the dire social and cultural aspects of that time, you know, like remove the mountain laundries and, you know, like authoritarian control from certain aspects of Irish culture at that time, but retained the environmental benefits. Like it, like that, that's what we're talking about, you know.
They also weren't absolutely, they weren't absolutely, you know, consumed by consumption either. And yeah, the necessity, and, you know, and of course that links to mental health as well. And we know that in terms of, you know, the mental health crisis and how much consumption and is related to that. And we've seen that with Facebook and Instagram and that. But I do think that there is a cultural change required and is underway as well. And that will be the question of how this battle ensues into the future and how the value systems, you know, happen. But I do feel hopeful, actually.
Can I come in on one point?
Yeah.
So Sinead already mentioned it, but, you know, the big cow in the room is agricultural emissions. Mm-hmm. And we haven't really touched on it. And I don't know, you may have seen in the last couple of days that the Farmers Journal published a report that they commissioned from KPMG, looking at the negative effects they expect on the agricultural industry from the 50% reduction in emissions that is required by 2030 at a global level, and they're saying that it will cost up to $4 billion to the industry and will lead to up to 56,000 job losses. Now, I haven't read the report in full myself, but, you know, so I can't analyze those figures. But I do think it is really important that we recognize the value of farmers in Irish society and recognize the importance of sitting down with farmers and designing the path forward together. And, you know, we fail to do that with the workers in the Midlands. There were some efforts at a Just Transition Commission, but far too late for it to be meaningful and far too late for it to really, I would say, protect the dignity of those workers and their families and the communities in the Midlands that have done so much to, you know, to provide us with energy for so long, and the Bordermona plants. And so we can't repeat that mistake with the farming communities. We really need to recognise and respect the role that they play in society and sit down with them now. And, you know, so as a plug for my line of work, you know, in every single community in Ireland, there are community workers working in local partnerships, working in community development projects, family resource centres. And these are the people with expertise in designing participatory processes that include people, make sure their voices are heard and are respected in decision making. And we need to be looking to that already existing infrastructure, local community development committees, public participation networks, and the community development projects, to be rolling out climate action in a way that brings people with us in the conversation, in the dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I absolutely agree with that. And I think we're going to end this marathon podcast now. We could probably keep going. And it is funny, some podcasts where I go in my head, because my son told me that he listened to this podcast, or so he knew of some podcasters who did like a 20 or 36 hour podcast or something, and it supposedly got loads of listens to. I'm sure it's probably just listened to as a background sleep sound or something like that. But listen, thank you so much, Jamie and Sinead. And just a reminder to listeners that if they do want to get involved in the protest, the Global Day of Action for Climate Justice, it is 12 o'clock on Saturday, this coming Saturday, 6th of November, starting from the Garden of Remembrance in Dublin. And the group that Aideen is part of, Not Here, Not Anywhere, that is, people can check that out as well. Thank you very much to Jamie Gorman, Sinead Mercier, and as well, just in terms of Reboot Republic, we are an independent media podcast with no sponsorship, no ads. And we really rely on listeners, on patrons to keep this podcast going. It costs to produce. If you can, if you value it, if you find the show is interesting, please support us by sharing them online. Let your friends know, share them around on WhatsApp, share them around on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Let people know you're listening, let people know what you're interested in, and contact us as well if there's guests you think you'd like us to have on, or comments you have. You can send us to rebootrepublic@gmail.com email. And yeah, thank you so much to our patrons who are keeping us going. And if you're not a patron, please consider one. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, sign up for whatever you can each month, help us keep these lights, which will be hopefully powered by renewable energy, or me cycling my bike, going. So listen, thank you so much, everyone, and talk to you all soon.